So everyone here, I think, knows that mindfulness is hot. It's on the cover of newspapers and magazines. There are TV specials about it. Mindfulness is big time. It's big time. So I think I'm going to touch on some topics that I talked about a couple of years ago, but they came up again in a conversation recently, so I'm going to go over some of them and a few other concepts. And this is about the dangers of mindfulness, which is sounds a little weird. It's not what you would expect to see on a magazine cover. What I'm talking about is some dangers in the way we misunderstand or misuse mindfulness, or the concept of mindfulness. So what is mindfulness? Just because we've been hearing about it so much, I'm going to talk about a couple of different definitions that you may have heard. I'm going to start with one that you've probably heard often, and that is knowing the truth of our experience as it arises in each moment. I've actually used this phrase in teaching a beginning meditation class. It's a pretty handy shorthand for mindfulness. Knowing the truth of our experience as it arises in each moment. Or you could also say fully receiving our experience. That is, having our experience without our usual narration, our stories, our worries, our concepts, all the sort of mental noise factors that tend to go into our experience day to day. But when you think about that definition, a dog fully knows the truth of her experience as it arises. But a dog certainly isn't free from cravings and aversions. And you know when you go away for the day that the dog is suffering. And you know when you open a food wrapper that the dog has cravings. So are we really aspiring to golden retriever mind, to doghood? I don't think so. So, just to expand on the idea of mindfulness, the Pali word that's usually translated to mindful is sati. And it means, you could translate it as reflection, or recall, or memory. And I kind of like that, because I think there is a reflective aspect to mindfulness. And by that I mean that when we're mindful, we know we're being mindful. There's a self-awareness there about the mindfulness. Another aspect, another shortcoming of this definition is that pickpockets are mindful. An unmindful pickpocket doesn't stay out of jail for very long. But a pickpocket is not cultivating happiness. Their practice, if you can call it that, is very narrow. In fact, you could say that perhaps that they're not really being mindful, that they just have really good, strong attention. But we're getting into some definitional stuff here. And other teachers have used this example. I know Philip Moffitt has, that pickpockets are mindful. So you can misuse mindfulness. So what's missing from a pickpocket's practice is sila, the practice of ethics. So there are other desirable qualities other than just mindfulness that or may not fall into the strict definition of mindfulness, but they seem essential if we're pursuing happiness, if we want to be better people, if that's the aim of our practice. So I like to think that mindfulness needs a larger context, a broader context in which to treat it. And there are a couple of elements in that. First is intention and attention. That is, how do we place our attention? Are we placing it mindfully? Are we placing it, are we using mindfulness in where we place our attention and how we place our attention? I'm going to elaborate on this later. And then what is our intention with respect to mindfulness? And I think in here we could probably agree that short term our intention is happiness and greater freedom. And long-term, our intention may be liberation, full liberation. So I think this is a broader context in which to look at sati, at mindfulness. And it's worthwhile bringing up here. And this may cover it. The term samasati, which usually is translated to wise mindfulness, sometimes as right mindfulness, could be appropriate mindfulness. And samasati, I think it's safe to say, includes ethics, partly because if you're trying to meditate, if you're trying to build a meditation practice, and you're not ethical, you're going to find out that remorse is really a huge block to practice. In fact, even if you've done unethical things in the past and you've set that aside and become an ethical person, dealing with old remorse for things that you've done in the past to do harm to people, that I don't know about you guys, but that keeps coming back to me. I keep having trouble with remorse for people that I've hurt in the past. The other element that I mentioned is reflection. Knowing that we're mindful, and besides that, knowing the fruits of mindfulness as we go along. I mean, the practice can get tough. If we don't actually see some benefits as we go along, it's very hard to stick with it. And if we pay attention, there are benefits and we can know them. And then the other issue, of course, is understanding the context in which we practice. So that might be a little bit iterative there. We know the context, and the context includes knowing the context. So there's some issues about mindfulness. There are ways that we screw it up, ways that we misuse the concept. So I'm going to talk about several of them. And first of all, and this starts by sounding pretty good, is that mindfulness is often taught as a way to deal with difficulties. And it is a good way to deal with difficulties. Many of you already know about the concept of the second arrow. This is a wonderful metaphor. I find it really helpful to keep coming back to it. As we know, the first arrow is stuff that happens to us. We get shot with a first arrow. You know, we stub our toe. We get a scary diagnosis from the doctor. Somebody who we intensely dislike becomes elected president. There are just things that happen that we can't avoid. The second arrow is the one that we shoot ourselves. The second arrow is the afflictive thought processes that grow, that proliferate around the first arrow. So we start, you know, the classic example is my knee hurts. Ah, I'm worried about my knee. Ah, I'll never walk again. I've got to get a knee replacement. I'm getting old. Oh, this is crappy. I really don't want to get old. I look awful. The thoughts just grow and grow until the knee just recedes into the background. It's almost like irrelevant. We've just gone off on a major snit. It turns out that neurophysical brain studies support this idea of the second arrow rather strongly. One study I saw, and I can't vouch for it, because I didn't have a chance to read up on the methodology, so I don't know how good this is. But they said that as much as 90% of our perceived suffering is this second arrow effect. As much as 90, now that seems high to me, but even if you go 50 to 80%, that's a lot. That's a huge proportion of what we see as our suffering is the second arrow, this afflictive stuff that we get into, that we add. As it is said, the first arrow is inevitable. The second arrow is optional. So a common teaching example about how we use mindfulness to deal with difficult situations that would normally get us into this cycle of afflictive thoughts is the pain in the knee. I already mentioned it. Good old pain in the knee. So let's say I have a pain in the knee. What we do is we aim our attention at the physical sensation of the knee and try to receive the experience without story or judgment. So we try to focus on the felt sense of the knee. We may perceive pressure or heat or tingling. And we focus on those actual perceptions, what's going on in our nervous system, rather than our concepts about the pain, our story about the pain. This can have the effect of deconstructing our experience, of interrupting the afflictive thought processes, which tend to be cyclic and self-reinforcing. If you interrupt that spiral, you can, oh, wow, where was I? Snap out of it, Bill. This can abate or even neutralize the second arrow, especially if you get good at it. Now, the first arrow, what's left over, the actual physical sensations, might be quite a bit more tolerable or even negligible. It's amazing how minor irritations become colossal calamities when we get into the second arrow. Now, by the way, this practice of deconstructing our experience and using mindfulness does not preclude wise action like taking an aspirin or seeing a doctor. Okay, let's not be stupid about this. There are things that do need attention in the physical world. It's not all second arrow. There is first arrow involved in a lot of this. So what's the big problem? Well, one thing is that we could come to see mindfulness as a useful tool for fixing things that go wrong, sort of like spiritual duct tape. So here's an example, for instance. Let's go back to the painful knee. It's such a useful metaphor. So my knee hurts and I want to stop it. I want to make it go away. So I sit down and I get that mindfulness thing cranked up. I've been reading about mindfulness. I get the mindfulness going and I aim it at my knee and it still hurts. It's, come on, go away, pain. It's not working. I must be doing it wrong. I'm really a crappy meditator. It's just a bad idea. This mindfulness stuff just doesn't work all that well, does it? So I end up with the pain with the first arrow. I still have the second arrow thoroughly cranked up. And then I've got the third arrow too, the judgment and the conflict that I've introduced in trying to use mindfulness to make it go away. So even when mindfulness does work, and it often does, it is a powerful technique if we use it mindfully, if we use it with some kind of broader awareness. But it's like in my medicine chest, I have a bottle of aspirin. It's a good thing to have in your medicine chest. I recommend it. But every time I see it, I think of headaches. Right? So if you use mindfulness only for the bad things, it makes us associate mindfulness with bad things. Sort of like mindfulness is in my spiritual toolkit to help me get out of unpleasant situations. And most of the time, I don't need to be mindful. I only need to be mindful when my knee hurts. Which reminds me of the opportunity for practice cliche. We've all heard that. Fortunately, I'm hearing it less often these days. There's this old thing about, oh, you don't like the noisy neighbor. It's an opportunity for practice. Wow, that really helps. Flat tires are an opportunity for practice. Illness is an opportunity for practice. And this also suggests that practice is only for bad things. And I think the real opportunity for practice is life in general, not just the bad things, but the good things as well. And then boring, ordinary, normal, banal things. And I'm going to come back to this in a little while. Another way we use mindfulness in an unskillful way is when we tell our friends to be more mindful. Say somebody drops something and you say, oh, you should be more mindful. Mindfulness doesn't necessarily cure absent-mindedness. For instance, people leave doors open or tops off of jars. It's easy to say, oh, you should be more mindful. Put the top back on the jar when you're done with it. Well, there are people who have attention deficit disorder, and mindfulness may not cure that. I know people who have went into practice in large part to try to cure attention deficit disorder. And the people that I'm thinking of have had all kinds of great benefits from their practice, but they still have ADD. That hasn't gone away. There are certain mental conditions of mind, like neurochemical situations in the mind, that really don't go away with mindfulness. One of the great things about mindfulness practice, and also a troubling thing, is that very often what you do is you start off and you want to solve a problem. Years later, you look back on it, you still have that problem, and you have all kinds of benefits that you didn't foresee at all. So this is a situation where you use the concept of mindfulness as a criterion for judging others, and often for ourselves. We do something and go, oh, I should have been more mindful. How often you do that, and you've just added something that's not terribly helpful. There's another phenomena about attention in general and about mindfulness, and that's a phenomena that bicyclists know about. And I first heard this, a friend of mine told me about it, and he couldn't quite remember what it was, and he said, oh yeah, I think it's called object gravity. And then later on he came up to me and said, no, it's actually called obstacle attraction. But I like object gravity a lot better, so I use that. It's a bicycling term, and you're driving down a trail somewhere, or maybe even a city street, and you see a pothole. And so you think to yourself, I've got to avoid that pothole. I really got to not go into that pothole. I really got to avoid driving into that pothole. If you do that, you will go into the pothole. It's just guaranteed. I know this. I've done this. Bicycling in Croatia, I had an obstacle, and I thought, I've got to really avoid that. I've got to not run into that obstacle. I gashed my knee rather badly. Back to the hurt knee thing. We've got a theme developing here. So cyclists know that when you see a pothole, the way to deal with it is not to focus on the pothole. You quickly look at where you want to go, and you focus there. You don't focus on the place you don't want to go to. So what this is all about is a concept from martial arts. Energy follows attention. This is important. You place your attention somewhere and the energy goes there. This is a great concept. It's very useful. So to go back to focusing on unpleasant things, using mindfulness for unpleasant things only, is that it can magnify the unpleasantness if we're not skillful in how we apply the mindfulness. Did I mention that energy follows attention? Okay, it does. And I'm going to talk more about this as well. And I just want to mention addiction as well. Let's say I'm trying to quit drinking beer, and all my friends are drinking beer, and I really have to focus on not having that delicious-looking ice-cold beer. Oh, boy. I have to really think hard about not having that beer. I have to keep focused on not having that. Oh, well, the hell with it. So in addiction as well, focusing too much on that which you are trying to get away from is probably going to lead you back to it, because it's just too much fun, too tasty. It's worthwhile taking a little bit of a digression here into the issue of depression. We had a teacher here a number of years ago who talked about the danger of using mindfulness for depression, which surprised me. I thought, oh no, depression, that'd be really amenable to treatment by mindfulness. And it can be. But you know, if you've been depressed, and I'm fortunate, I've never been chronically depressed. I have been depressed for periods of time, not for many years, but I'm not chronically depressed. So I'm treating this a little bit as an outsider. But with depression, there is a sense of crushing, of suffocation, or of being in quicksand. And there's a feeling of a downward spiral. And there's very much a self-referencing, self-reinforcing aspect to it mentally. So using wise mindfulness, you can break this cycle. You can break this spiral. But you could also, if you're not careful, reinforce it. And that's what this teacher was saying, is that if you really focus on that sense of downward spiral, you could feel that even more so than you might normally. So there's a danger there of reinforcing the effect rather than breaking it, rather than interrupting it. In depression, there's this circular logic as well, this mental stuff that goes on. Happy people are shallow and trivial. If you were happy in the past, it was because you were deluded. And mindfulness can really help break that cycle. You can observe the mind and you can decide whether you believe it or not. It's like that wonderful bumper sticker that says, don't believe everything you think. This is really good therapy in this case. But I want to emphasize that depression is not a do-it-yourself project. As Jack Kornfield says, the mind is a dangerous place. Don't go there alone. If you're working with chronic depression, this is really an area where you need an outside observer, like a therapist or a good teacher, to help you make sure that you're breaking the cycle rather than reinforcing it. So another trap to mindfulness, or a misunderstanding of mindfulness, is that we are often not mindful of good things. Especially if we're using mindfulness as sort of the equivalent of aspirin to fix bad things. We have a capacity for joy. We have a capacity for happiness. But we often don't notice it when it happens. I think it's always around us. It's always in us. But we don't notice it. And when we do notice it, we usually chalk it up to external circumstances, and we do whatever we can to hold on to it or amp it up. It's like the guy sitting on the beach, the sunset, he's got a piña colada, the weather is beautiful. Oh, I wish this could go on forever. You know, it's like all of a sudden the grabbing onto it takes away from the actual experience. We're actually inducing some friction there. We're actually adding unhappiness when we could be just enjoying the sunset and the piña colada. So why do we focus on bad things? This is an opportunity for me to talk about Lucy and Tilly. So Lucy, as you know, was the remains of our hominid ancestor who was discovered in Olduvai Gorge in East Africa. So Lucy lived a long, long time ago in the savannah. So I like to imagine her out there with her friend Tilly, walking around looking for food. Right, you haven't heard of Tilly, and there's a reason for that. So they're walking around for food, and Tilly says, "Oh, look, berries, those look delicious. Let's go eat some." And Lucy says, "Wait, did I just hear a lion?" So imagine whose genes we've inherited. Because after all, surviving a day without berries is much easier than surviving a day in the stomach of a lion. So, and by the way, I think lions of today can be thankful for Tilly for helping to nourish their ancestors. We can be thankful for Lucy, who survived and has passed us her genes. But we inherited her worrywart aspects. So that's why we tend to be worrywarts. We're still looking for lions, and the berries are a secondary thought. Lucy's attention was on survival first, and enjoyment second, which is all about energy following attention. Nowadays, of course, we rarely have to worry about lions. Or, you know, occasionally you've got to worry about making the rent and so on, but we tend to obsess about it, and we do that rather than on focusing on the berries. And we really do have time and energy and the wherewithal to enjoy the berries occasionally. So I want to touch on a few other definitions of mindfulness. Here's one from Jon Kabat-Zinn. He says, "Mindfulness means paying attention in a particular way, on purpose, in the present moment, and non-judgmentally." Which is nice, and it does address the reflection issue, because he says on purpose. You can't be mindful on purpose unless there's some kind of feedback mechanism there. But on the other hand, does on purpose preclude spontaneous mindfulness? And many of us have had the experience, especially on retreat, of just, you know, walking down to the dining hall or something, and all of a sudden, unexpectedly, there's this moment of terrific clarity. Just real stillness. And then, of course, the mind kicks in and goes, "Oh, wow, that's cool. Do that again." But I really think there's a capacity for spontaneous mindfulness. And this doesn't really address that. That's something that you can cultivate, and it's a wonderful treat when it happens. But it just happens. And the other thing that bothers me is there's nothing explicitly about ethics in that. Joseph Goldstein, and this is something he said from a retreat in 2012. I was there. This is from my notes, so it's a paraphrase. Mindfulness is always wholesome. It is accepting and doesn't identify, so there are no hindrances in it. Now, this kind of shocked me, because by definition, hindrances, the five hindrances, which are desire and lust, the second one is hatred and aversion, the third one is sloth and torpor, which has a wonderful Gothic sound to it, the fourth is agitation and worry, and the fifth is doubt. And they're always there, usually in combinations, often very, very, very subtle. But it is said that they go away in some of the deep absorption states of meditation. So does this mean, that does Joseph Goldstein's statement mean that unless you are in a state of jhana, you are not being mindful? And I don't think he means that. And maybe he's implying that there is a continuum between total absent-mindedness on one hand and non-dual perception on the other. I don't know, but I realized after I read through all this stuff that I was just sick of reading definitions of mindfulness. Yeah. And there's another thing. Shia?
Well, maybe he means the process of being aware just in and of itself is a pure state. All those other things are things to be aware of.
But somebody did ask him that, and he said no, he was talking about mindfulness, not just awareness. So I think what I wanted to get to is that we can go on and on about definition of mindfulness, and it's kind of fun, and it's good for a start. But mindfulness is one of those things that if you've been practicing for a while, you know it when you feel it. You know when it's there. You know partly that it's an embodied experience. There's a real aha quality. It's not just a light bulb going on in the head. There's something happening in the body as well. Just to return to an earlier theme, I think that we want mindfulness of more than just bad stuff, that a practice that is balanced includes feelings of joy and happiness and freedom, and also of just normal things, boring, ordinary moments. Mindfulness can be a full-time practice, not just a panacea for suffering. And mindfulness, I think, at its most useful, at its best, is not to fix things, but to directly experience our lives, including happiness and joy. It's worth pointing out that the Buddha approved of happiness. And he had and taught many practices for the cultivation of happiness. So remember that energy follows attention? I did mention that, didn't I? So if we want to be happier, one of the aspects of energy following attention is to direct our attention towards happiness, to start noticing it, to start allowing it to be a part of our lives, to be a part of our perception, to be in our awareness. So I have some practice suggestions. These are mostly things that have helped me or helped people that I know. And one is that when you're working with an unpleasant state, say the old hand and knee, see if you can find a place in the body that feels good, or even if it feels neutral. Say your knee hurts. Well, you know, maybe the palms of your hands have a nice warmth and a tingle to them. They might feel actually kind of good, not too bad. Your earlobes might be fabulous. You know, there may be parts of your body that you can focus on and realize that it's not all about your knee. This, by the way, may not work for extreme states, like, for instance, you know, severe pain or for grief something like that, you're probably not going to be able to find stuff like that. But this is really nice, very effective if you're, say, grumpy, or if you've got that famous sore knee. Another thing that I like to do is sit with a slight smile on the lips, the way I directed in the guided meditation. This sounds silly. When I first heard it, it sounded silly, but actual brain scan studies have shown that it actually does have an effect. It probably has something to do with mirror neurons. Mirror neurons are almost as popular as mindfulness itself, but it's worth citing them here, that that this does have an effect, and it's worth noticing. And if not, notice that too. But it's really worth trying, maybe not all the time. Something else that I did in the guided sit is gratitude practice. I really like gratitude practice. I do a lot of metta practice, which I also, when I first started metta practice, it just sounded silly. But I found that, first of all, I found a way of doing metta that worked for me. It's not the standard practice. And second, I found that starting with gratitude was a really great way to kickstart it. And when I talk about practicing gratitude, I mean practice gratitude embodied. Feel it not just as a good mood or something that we think of as an event up in the coconut, but something that you feel in the body. There can be real pleasure in the body when the gratitude is strong. And it can be there, but quite subtle when the gratitude is not so strong. See if you can find it. Not forcing it, but open to the possibility that's there. Just opening to possibility. When you do feel happiness or peace, maybe something's come up. Maybe you're just sitting there looking at a loved one and you suddenly feel this stab of pleasure. Notice it, and notice it how it feels in the body, rather than thinking of, oh, that's nice, or how can I get more of that? Or thinking of it as just something that you have no control over. Notice it in the body. It's hard to cultivate something if you don't know what it feels like. Good moods are not just events in the head. They are embodied, but we tend not to notice them. There's a really interesting technique that I have found helpful, and I know other people have. Philip Moffitt calls it the imaginative possible. And in this situation, what it would be is if you can't find a pleasant feeling or can't find the feeling of happiness in the body, imagine what it would feel like if you could feel it. And just open to that possibility. Now, not trying to force anything again, but being open and curious about it. I first used the imaginative possible as a way of, I wanted to switch my breathing focus from the back of my throat to the nose area, to the nostrils and the upper lip, because many teachers recommend this as a concentration practice. Other teachers dismiss it, other teachers recommend against it, so, you know, go figure. But I wanted to do that, and I found it very helpful as a practice. But I couldn't find my breath there. I couldn't feel it anywhere. I spent a half an hour in practice trying to imagine what it would feel like if I could. By the end of the half hour, I was very comfortable with following the breath at the nostril, and still am. So that one application of the imaginative possible has informed my practice for years. And I don't have to keep doing it. It's there. I've just used it for other things as well, though. So using the imaginative possible and being open to the possibility rather than trying to force it. These practices, one of the things that they can help with is a phenomenon that some teachers call the sweet breath or the beautiful breath. Sweet breath or beautiful breath is also something that comes up in deep concentration practice. So you'll hear about it sometimes in a concentration retreat, or if you're reading a book by somebody like Ajahn Brahmavamsa, who is a teacher of deep absorption practice, talks about the beautiful breath. This is where the breath becomes so pleasant Or it starts very subtly. Breath is slightly pleasant. Ooh, that's interesting. All of a sudden, it's easier to stay with the breath because it's pleasant. The breath gets more pleasant. Oh, that's more interesting. And you find that the concentration starts to become easier. It becomes sort of a beneficial cycle of self-reinforcing thing because the breath is so pleasant. And that pleasantness, by the way, is piti and sukha. Piti is usually translated as rapture or joy. Sukha is usually translated as happiness. One of them, the piti is sort of upbeat, bright, sparkly, energetic. The sukha is soothing, placid even. And these are beautiful qualities, and they can help lead towards the deeper concentration. So some gratitude practice can really help kickstart some of these sensations of piti and sukha when you're starting a sit or when you're on a meditation retreat. The important thing here is to experiment and be curious. Different things work for different people. None of this stuff may work for you. Maybe all of it does. And there are other practices that I haven't talked about that may also be effective. But one thing that I believe is that happiness can be cultivated. It's not just something you sit around and can wait for. It's something that can be cultivated. So just to recap here, to go back to some of the problems with mindfulness and some of the issues that I brought up. First is understanding the context of mindfulness, the ethics, because mindfulness here is in service of a larger practice. We want to become happier. We want to become better people. We want to be on a path to liberation. So ethics, reflection, knowing that we're mindful and knowing the fruits of mindfulness, and then skillful means, also known as wise meditation. That is, knowing how and where to place the attention. And I'll touch on this again. It'd be good if we could avoid using mindfulness only to fix bad stuff. That gives us the wrong impression of what mindfulness is and what it's good for. There's the danger of using the concept of mindfulness to judge ourselves and others. There's the danger of adding energy to afflictive states, falling into the trap of object gravity. This goes back to being skillful about where we place attention and how we place attention. And then the biggest thing, I think, that I'd like to see people get from this is being mindful of good things. It's so easy to be mindful of bad things. Let's be mindful of good things. As our mindfulness practice develops, so yes, I'm coming out in favor of mindfulness here, after all that. As our mindfulness practice develops, and many of you are already aware of some of these fruits already, we find more freedom by breaking old patterns. We get to turn off the automatic pilot for a while. When we get to observe our mind, we realize how much of our actions are out of pattern, out of habit. We're acting as if on automatic pilot. There's no gap between the stimulus and the response. We just act without thought, without any volition. As our practice improves, we find that intuition can start arising more naturally, more often, because we get out of the way of intuition. Most of the time, we're telling ourselves a story. We've got a narration. We've seen it all before. We've got this ability to abstract, which is a wonderful tool, by the way. It's greatly important. It really helps us in a lot of situations. But we're not always seeing what's going on right in front of us. There's been a lot of experimentation about that. Many of you have heard about the experiment where people are told to watch video. In the video, there is some kind of simple ball game going on. People are tossing balls at each other. The idea is you're supposed to count how often a certain colored ball is exchanged or something. And then at the end, people report how many balls were, I forget what it is, were tossed, or how many white balls were tossed, something simple like that. But in the middle of the video, somebody walks across the screen in a gorilla outfit. And when I first heard this, I thought, oh yeah, it's probably people in the distance, it's probably pretty subtle. And then I finally saw the video, and it's really pretty shocking. You've got like two or three people standing there, full size in the video, and then a gorilla walks across the screen. So when people asked those viewers, what about the gorilla? They said, what gorilla? They were so involved in watching the balls get tossed that they didn't see the gorilla. They were too involved in the story. They've been given a story, and they stuck to that story. So intuition is actually responding to what's going on. We can find all kinds of things. You know, the old saying about the gut feeling. By the way, this is an aside. The gut has more dopamine receptors than the brain does. So trust your gut feelings. As the mindfulness practice deepens, we can observe our own mental processes, even while they're happening. This is really interesting. You can watch what you're doing while you're doing it. You can watch what your mind is doing while you're doing it. And things start to slow down when that happens. It's almost like quarterbacks report that after their first year in the pros, everything seems to be slower. It's not slower. Their brains are working faster. Their stories are getting out of their way. Instead of saying, oh, who's open? Who do I look at next? It's all instinct. It's all the training. They just look and look and look and then throw. Their minds are out of the way. Things slow down. And when you start noticing how your brain works, it's like what's going on in your brain seems to slow down. It's not really slowing down. It's just that your ability to observe is faster. And what happens, a lot of people report this, is that you start finding some space between that stimulus and reaction. You don't have to be on the automatic pilot anymore. You find that space. Space is a wonderful metaphor here. We had two convicts, ex-convicts here. They both spent many decades in prison for serious crimes. And one of them used a phrase that I love and I use a lot. He said that the meditation practice had given him the ability to find the space between anger and violence and the space between craving and using. He'd been used all his life to anger arises, violence ensues. It just happens, you know, it's automatic. You crave a drug, you go out and you score some and use it. There's no gap, there's no volition there. And he found volition, he found that gap, that space that allowed him to actually make a decision. That he found that he had more freedom in the moment, in every moment. And having that freedom allows us to make sure that we follow our intention. And that our intentions reflect our highest values. And that is a way of saying that we can be true to ourselves in the moment, in any moment. Maybe not all the time. Try not to be judgmental if we fail to. But there's so much more opportunity for us to be true to ourselves in the moment. We can respond the way we aspire rather than react like automatons. So noticing that we can be aware of suffering, but the awareness itself is not suffering. This goes back to, I think awareness is, what you said, Shaya, is awareness is like a container. It itself is neutral, although there's something very pleasant about being in that container. But awareness itself is not suffering. No matter how much suffering is going on in your life, the awareness itself does not suffer. Attention, mindfulness, these are all things that go on within the awareness. The suffering doesn't define us, it's just a characteristic of our experience. I'm going to go back to depression for a minute, because this reminds me of I was involved with a few other people in a conversation with Aya Ananda Bodhi a couple of years ago. Now, Aya Ananda Bodhi is a Western-born Theravada nun. And she said that she's had trouble with chronic depression. And it used to be a terrible problem for her. And after years of meditation, somebody asked her, well, has it gone away? And she said, no, I still get depression. But my relationship to it is different. It's almost like when it shows up again, it's maybe not like an old friend, but an old acquaintance. Sort of like, oh, you again. And she said this. This was her phrase. The depression did not define her. It's just a characteristic of her experience. Something that occurred within this container of the awareness. Ed Brown, another teacher who's been here a number of times, says, your awareness is the sky. Everything in that sky is just weather. And weather is impermanent. The sky, at least in terms of our lifetimes, we can think of as permanent. So one thing I'd like to leave with here is to urge you to start noticing and being mindful of happiness and joy. So we have time for maybe one or two questions before we do our end with our loving kindness practice. Anybody? Yeah, right. You've got the mic. It's on the table. I see it.
We tend not to be very patient in our culture. And I've noticed that developing a little mindfulness can almost sort of trick you into... Well, it's not the mindfulness, it's your mind that's tricking you into thinking that somehow you are not subject to causes and conditions. Mm. And so the other day I was, I have a rental car, and I was driving it. My husband was in the passenger side, and I was driving down the street to make a, about to make a left turn, and I had a green arrow to make that turn, and the oncoming car, as I started to make my turn, I noticed that she wasn't stopping. And I said to myself, a little bit mindful, I guess, I was awake enough that I said, I have to accelerate and get through quickly before she hits my husband. And so I started to do that, but my foot hit the brake. I knew it was in my mind. I'm a mindful person, but I couldn't overcome the fact that I have 40 years of driving experience that says something, you know, happened, you should stop. And so that was those were the causes and conditions, being that the condition is my body is trained to this reflex to hit the brake.
And most of the time, that's probably a good thing to do. I mean, it's not, the reflexes are not a bad thing. It's sort of like, especially driving. You know, it's easy to say, oh yeah, be mindfulness all the time, as if spacious awareness, as if you don't have a story about anything. But if you're driving around and you only see shapes and colors, you're unlikely to behave skillfully. So this might not have been the best thing for you to do at the time, but in a sense, what you were doing was, what your body knows how to do in driving is still a good thing. So this ability to abstract, this ability, it's sort of like, don't get into non-dual awareness when you're driving a car. It's just not a good idea.
Well, that's what, I instantly, fortunately she stopped, and we're here, obviously. And but I instantly said, and I said to my husband, you know, I knew I needed to accelerate, but my foot wouldn't listen to my brain. And part of me was sort of blaming myself. Why wasn't I more mindful that I could control this? And that's sort of the delusion that I
right.
was referring to.
It's because you're a bad person. Anybody else? You've got one more.
I just wanted to say, it's pretty clear that mindfulness isn't going to fix aging.
Excuse me?
It's not going to fix aging.
Right. It can change your relationship to the aging phenomenon, but it won't make you young.
No, nor even arrest it.
Right.
That's all I'm asking for.
Well, then just meditate harder. Well, even the Buddha, died of old age and old age-related stuff. He had bad knees, he had a bad back, he had pain.
Then somebody poisoned him.
Well, that's what Stephen Batchelor says. Yep. That's a whole different story. And I'll have to tell that story sometime. Or come to dinner and have a beer with us, and I'll tell you there.
Somewhere you're making a distinction between awareness and mindfulness.
Yes.
But I don't understand the distinction because, it's talked about mindfulness is bare awareness to the extent necessary to see what is happening at the moment. Mm-hmm. And that's one definition of how to be mindful of things. So I'm confused about the difference between, as you see it, between awareness and mindfulness.
Well, a lot of this is about words, and different teachers probably use different definitions. But I think mindfulness, there's the quality of knowing that you're mindful, and there's certainly the quality of there being a lot less mental noise. So there's a lot less between you and the pure awareness. But the mindfulness is still something happening within awareness. I mean, I think of it that way. There's certainly a lot less noise factor, but the mindfulness, for instance, can be focused, and awareness itself is very broad. Mm-hmm. Things like attention happen within awareness, attention or lack thereof. There's sort of, you could argue that there are qualities of awareness, but I find them helpful to think of them as being things that take place within the broader container of awareness.